So yeah, I've got 12 chapters to get through, and for me, that's a stretch in a concise amount of time because we've got communion. So I'm going to get right into it. We're continuing our series, living in His story or living in history, and this is all about as we see the Bible as God's story, all the way from Genesis through Revelation, and how we fit into His story. And so we're going to continue on with that. Last week, Pastor Jeff was sharing what God was doing in the life and times of Abraham and how it culminated with Abraham trusting God, even with the life of his son Isaac. After a long-awaited time where they were waiting for Isaac, that he trusted God with Isaac's life. It was a pivotal moment up into that point in the story that we've been hearing. We've also been carefully watching three themes from the beginning as we journey through his story. The first theme that we've talked about is God is up to something, right? He is actively working at bringing back the shalom or the peace that was lost at the fall in order to restore relationships with each other and with him. And second, Satan is actively working at destroying God's shalom. He is all about destroying relationships. He is actively working at disrupting unity in the church so the name of Jesus will be discredited. And if that isn't enough that's working against us, the third theme that we're watching as we go through this story is left to our own devices. Without the grace and power of the Holy Spirit, we naturally move away from God. We are our own worst enemies at times. So keep those in mind as we're going through this. Today we're going to dig into what God did through the amazing life of Joseph. But first, I'm going to do a quick recap or bring you up to speed of what happened after we last talked to the beginning of the story of Joseph. So we're looking at passages from Genesis 23 through 36. And so just quickly, there's a few points here. So in these chapters, what we see is Abraham's wife Sarah dies. Abraham then goes and sends his servant away to find a wife for Isaac from the land that he had originally come from. He didn't want Isaac marrying a foreigner. He wanted someone from his family. We then see Abraham dies at the age of 175 years. Next, what we see as we read through, Isaac and Rebekah, that's his wife, they have twins. So the first boy that comes out, his name is Esau, and the second son was Jacob. God foretells that the younger would rule the older. And so in this time period, that is totally opposite of what happens. The birthright goes to the first son, to the oldest. But sure enough, one day Esau comes in from the fields, and he's famished. He's hungry. He's tired. And he asked Jacob, he walks in and he asked Jacob for some of his stew. And this is Jacob's response in Genesis 25, verse 31. He says, "All right," Jacob replied, "but trade me your rights as the firstborn son." You see, Esau was famished. He was hungry. He was dying inside. And so he relented. And he sat down and he had bread and stew, and he grew to despise his birthright. Next, what we see, God makes a covenant with Jacob, and we see it playing out in Genesis 26, verses 3 to 5. God makes this promise, and he says, "Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you, and I will bless you. For to you and to your offering, I will give all of these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham, your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and will give to your offspring all of these lands. And in your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Right? He's continuing on with the covenant and the promise that he's made in the story we've already heard. He's continuing on in that same line with Jacob. So what are we learning here? We're learning that God keeps his promises. He does not waver. Next, we continue on in the story, and we see that Jacob tricks Isaac into blessing himself instead of Esau. You see, Isaac's getting old. His eyesight is failing, and Jacob dresses up, disguises himself as Esau, and Isaac blesses him. And then when Esau comes in, he's upset as again he felt cheated. This is the second time he feels cheated. Next, what we see is Jacob goes back to the land of his forefathers, as did his dad Isaac, to find a wife. He falls in love with Rachel. This is his uncle Laban's daughter. And I don't know about anybody else here, but it wasn't as simple back then as maybe it is now. Not that marriage is simple, but here's what happens. Laban says, sure, but you have to work for me for 7 years. So what does he do? He works for him for 7 years. And Laban says, yep, you can marry my daughter. And then somehow Laban tricks him into marrying his oldest daughter, Leah. Too much to his surprise. And so, obviously, Jacob's upset. And he goes, you know, what's going on? And Laban goes, well, that's not the way it's done. You have to marry your oldest daughter first. And so he goes, but you can marry my younger daughter, but you have to work another 7 years. Sure enough, he works another 7 years for him. That's right. He has two wives. All right. In this time, Jacob, who God now calls Israel, he's coming up to his brother, and he's afraid, right? Esau has felt cheated in the past a couple of times by Jacob, and Jacob is scared and because of what Jacob has done in the past. He can't come to trust Esau. No matter how much Esau implores him, he can't come to trust him. Jacob lets his insecurities get the best of him, and it gets in the way of them repairing their relationship. And finally, we see that God blesses Jacob with 12 sons in all and at least one daughter. Not only that, we see that his flocks flourish. His flocks of sheep, they grow large. And so God has made him prosperous, both in family and in the flocks of his sheep. So through here, we see in our story our major themes that are at work. We see throughout the journey that God is up to something. God is in control no matter our failings, no matter if we are obeying him. God's going to do what God's going to do. God's will ends up being accomplished no matter what. We see through these lives that we've looked at that often each of them is their own worst enemy. They get in the way of themselves. Our sin and pride holds us back from God using us fully. And so that takes us up to today, to the story that we're actually going to get into. So we're well into God's epic story. We're going to be looking through, yes, 12 chapters, chapters 37 and then 39 to 49 of Genesis. It brings us to the time of Joseph. But as we've seen in previous chapters and in the stories that we've already seen, that if you focus on the people of the story, you're missing the point. Because this story is totally about what God is doing through them. The story is primarily about God. And so we find in chapter 37, Joseph is 17 years old. And guess what? He's disliked by his brothers. Why is he disliked? Well, chapter 37 gives us four reasons right off the bat. You know, Joseph is either infinitely naive or the ultimate brat of a younger brother. But let's talk about the four reasons why his brothers disliked him. In Genesis 37, verse 2, it says this. This is the account of Jacob and his family. When Joseph was 17 years old, he often tended his father's flocks. He worked for his half-brothers, the sons of his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. But Joseph reported to his father some of the bad things his brothers were doing. So reason number one of their dislike, he snitched on them. No one likes someone who snitches. Let's continue. In verse 4, it says, but his brothers hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. They couldn't say a kind word about him. Reason number two, their dad loved him more. Let's continue as Joseph shares a dream with his brothers in verses 7 and 8. We were out in the field tying up bundles of grain. Suddenly, my bundle stood up, and your bundles all gathered around and bowed low before mine. His brothers respond, so you think you will be our king, do you? Do you actually think you will reign over us? And they hated him all the more because of the dreams and the way he talked about them. Reason number three, Joseph dreamed that his brothers would all serve him. And he told them. And lastly, in verse 9, Joseph says this, soon Joseph had another dream. And again, soon Joseph had another dream, and again he told his brothers about it. Listen, I have had another dream, he said. The sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed low before me. Reason four, the second dream showed not only his brothers, but his entire family would serve him. Now, depending if you are an older sibling or a younger sibling, it may skew how you feel about Joseph. Yet, he couldn't control who his dad loved. He couldn't control the dreams that God had given him. So far, you know, even though his brothers, you know, they totally dislike him and they've ostracized him, life's pretty good for Joseph. It's pretty good. He's well loved by his dad, but it's pretty good. Now, Israel, or Jacob, he sends Joseph out to check on his brothers pasturing the flock. And they see him coming from a long ways away. And guess what? They conspire to kill him. They conspire to kill him and blame it on a fierce animal slaughtering him. Now, one of his brothers, Reuben, he's not at all happy about this. He talks the rest of his brothers out of killing him and just throwing him into a pit that he can't get out of, where there's no water in it or nothing. And he had plans to come back after his brothers left and saving him. And so that's what they did. They throw Joseph down into this pit. And so the brothers, first, before they throw him down in there, they strip his robe off him, and they throw him in the pit. Okay, so here they're eating their lunch outside of this pit, and they see these Ishmaelite traders, this caravan of traders coming their way. And they get a brilliant idea. Instead of just leaving him in the pit, why don't we sell him? Right? What all older brothers would think of doing to their younger brother, why don't we just sell him to these traders? Right? So that's what they do. They end up selling him and going back and taking that robe, dipping in goat's blood, and telling their dad he died. Not telling them anything about selling their brother. And so these traders end up taking Joseph, and they end in turn sell him to Potiphar, the captain of the Egyptian guard. So we've got Joseph, whose life was pretty good, and then now not so good, right? it's pretty bad at this point. It couldn't seem that it could get any worse. You know, what would you be thinking right now? If it's me, it's pretty tempting to do the woe is me thing. But God is with Joseph. And we see that in this next section, in Genesis 39, verses 2 to 4. The Lord was with Joseph, so he succeeded in everything he did as he served in the home of his Egyptian master. Potiphar noticed this and realized that the Lord was with Joseph, giving him success in everything he did. This pleased Potiphar, so he soon made Joseph his personal attendant. He put him in charge of his entire household and everything he owned. You see, God is in charge. We've seen this theme all the way throughout. God is up to something that is more than we appreciate, and even if we're in the middle of this crisis, there's no way we can see what God is doing. Is this something that we can all relate to? Because it is something I can totally relate to. When you're in the middle of a valley, to be honest, when you're in the middle of a peak, when things are going really well, it is hard to see what God is doing. But when you're in the middle of a struggle or a crisis, the temptation is to claw and scratch just to get out of that situation, rather than trusting God, rather than trusting Him and seeing what He's doing. So now life is much better for Joseph. The Lord blessed Potiphar's house for Joseph's sake. Joseph worked hard for Potiphar, and he was a great servant for him. He was in full control over all of his stuff, over his household. And then Potiphar's wife notices him. He's a pretty good-looking guy, and she's attracted to him. And she tells him she wants to lie with him. And Joseph says, no. He says, no. He says, I have loyalty to Potiphar. Look at what he's done for me. He's put me in charge of all of this stuff. He says, no. But Potiphar, not to be dismayed, she waits for all of the men to leave. And she grabs him. And she tells him again that she wants to lie with him. And Joseph struggles to get away from her, and he's wearing a garment or a cloak around him, and she grabs a hold of that, and he lets that go, and he flees, and she's sitting here holding his garment. So she thinks for a second, and Potiphar's wife screams and tells everyone that Joseph wanted to lie with her, and when she screamed, he fled, leaving his garment. So you know what Potiphar was. Potiphar was extremely angry. He's upset. And poor Joseph gets thrown into prison. Again. Up, down. Life is pretty miserable for Joseph. He's in prison. One would wonder how so many unfair things could happen to one person. And yet again, God was with Joseph, even in his struggles. God gave Joseph favor with the keeper of the prison. Whatever Joseph did, God made it a success. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners and all that went down in the prison. And they were blessed. One day, while Joseph was in prison, he's talking to the king's cupbearer and his baker. You see, they ended up getting into trouble and getting thrown into prison. And they were sharing that they had these dreams and they could not make any sense of their dreams. And Joseph responds with this in Genesis 40, verse 8. He says, well, first that they said, and they replied, we both had dreams last night, but no one can tell us what they mean. Interpreting dreams is God's business, Joseph replied. Go ahead and tell me your dreams. Joseph interprets their dreams and tells the cupbearer that he would be restored to his office within 3 days. He then tells the baker that in 3 days, Pharaoh's going to put him to death. And sure enough, what ends up happening? Both of those things come to pass. But before the cupbearer leaves, Joseph pleads with them to make sure that he tells Pharaoh of what has happened. But the cupbearer doesn't tell Pharaoh. 2 more years pass. Again, not good for Joseph. He's languishing in prison for 2 more years. In Genesis 41, it goes on, and it's in verses 1 to 4, it says, 2 full years later, Pharaoh dreams that he was standing on the bank of the Nile River. In his dream, he saw 7 fat, healthy cows come up out of the river and begin grazing in the marsh grass. Then he saw 7 more cows come up behind them from the Nile. But these were scrawny and thin. These cows stood beside the fat cows on the riverbank. Then the scrawny, thin cows ate the 7 healthy, fat cows. At this point in the dream, Pharaoh woke up. And it continues on in verse 5. But he fell asleep again and had a second dream. This time he saw 7 heads of grain, plump and beautiful, growing on a single stalk. Then 7 more heads of grain appeared, but these were shriveled and withered by the east wind. And these thin heads swallowed up the 7 plump, well-formed heads. Then Pharaoh woke up again and realized it was a dream. No one in all of Pharaoh's employ could tell him what these dreams meant. No one. Then his cupbearer goes, huh, you know, I know this guy. I was in prison. And he tells him about Joseph. And so Pharaoh hears this story about Joseph. And he calls, and then he immediately calls for him. But, you think of what's happening here to Joseph. Let's think about it. He was put in a pit. He sold to slavers. He sold to Potiphar. He's put in prison. He interprets the dream, but it still languishes for another 2 years. You can only imagine before Pharaoh calls for him what his state of mind would be. You know, what would your state of mind be? Mine would be dismay. Mine would be self-pity. Right? Let's see what Joseph's is. In 41 verses 15 and 16, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream last night, and no one here can tell me what it means, but I've heard that you hear about a dream and you can interpret it. It is beyond my power to do this, Joseph replied. But God can tell you what it means and set you at ease. But God can do it. Today, culture tells us that we should never struggle. We deserve things right now. Instead of struggling until we can afford something, culture tells us we should just go in debt and get it right now because we deserve it. Our culture today is all about self, all about now. Most people would be thinking about themselves after all the struggles that Joseph is going through. But not Joseph. He gives God all of the glory, as even at that point. Joseph tells Pharaoh his 2 dreams are in fact one. He tells him that it speaks of 7 good years that are coming, followed by 7 bad years. The famine will consume the land and all will perish unless drastic action is taken. He tells Pharaoh that he needs to appoint overseers to take the produce of the land in the 7 good years and store it up for the 7 years of famine. And so what does Pharaoh do? He sees no one in his employ that can do that. And he sees that God is using Joseph, and he puts him in charge of everything. Joseph becomes second to Pharaoh alone. And that's it. All by the age of 30 years old. In the 7 years of abundance, they piled up food on top of food. It piled so high that they couldn't measure how much they had. Then the famine came to Egypt and beyond. And the famine spread and it spread. This is what it says in 41:57. Of Genesis. It says, and people from all around came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe throughout the world. So people came from all over, including Joseph's family. Right? Jacob had heard that they were selling grain in Egypt, and he sends some of his sons, all but his youngest. He sends some of his sons to go buy some. So they load up their caravan and they trek out to Egypt. They came and bowed to Joseph and they don't recognize him. It's been many years. Joseph has changed. And Joseph does not let on. Joseph recognizes them, but he doesn't let on that he knows who they are. And so he tests his brothers. In Genesis 42, 18 to 20, it says this, on the third day, Joseph said to them, I'm a God-fearing man. If you do as I say, you will live. If you really are honest men, choose one of your brothers to remain in prison. The rest of you may go home with grain for your starving families. But you must return with your you must bring your youngest brother back to me. This will prove that you are telling the truth, and then you will not die. To this they agreed. You see, Joseph is testing them. All the while this is going on, Joseph is speaking through an interpreter just to carry on this charade. And the brothers are talking back and forth between them. And they're feeling guilty. They're feeling guilty because of the younger brother that they had sold into slavery years ago. And they feel that what's happening now is a reckoning for his blood. Joseph's understanding what they're saying, and he secretly weeps. And he gets their sacks filled with grain, and he secretly puts back the money that they were paying with. And the brothers make the trek back to Jacob. They unload all the grain and tell him everything that had happened. And then they find their money in all the bags is also there. They're worried that this Egyptian that gave them this grain is going to feel cheated. And he still has their brother. The famine is continuing. There is nothing growing. People are hungry. And so they need to go back. One, they need to get their brother. They need to get more grain. And they need to take their youngest brother, or they know that there's no way he's going to give them anything. They have to wrestle verbally with Jacob over this because Jacob is already missing Joseph so much. But Jacob relents and lets Benjamin, the youngest, go. As they return to Egypt, Joseph tells them not to be afraid. And come and feast. Joseph asks about their dad, if he is well. And so they tell him that their dad is well. And Joseph is overcome. He has to leave. He secretly leaves and he is overcome and he weeps and he weeps. Before he comes back, he has to wash his face. You know, life is good for Joseph right now. He is in charge of this super dynasty where the world is coming to him to get grain because of what God has done through him. But you see that he's, you know, the humanity in him. He's weeping because he is sad over what has happened. But Joseph has their caravan filled with grain again. He secretly returns their money again, and he puts his personal silver cup in the pack of Benjamin's stuff. Joseph sends his military after them. They hadn't gone very far, and Joseph sends his guard after them. They'd only been gone a short time, and they find the cup in Benjamin's stuff. Joseph threatens to keep Benjamin, and the brothers plead. They are distraught. They know that they cannot go back without Benjamin. They plead with him that if they return without Benjamin, their dad will surely die. Because previously, his other son did not return. And they know that their dad, it would be the end of their dad. And so they plead with him. Joseph is so overcome with sympathy, and he cries. He has to send all the people out of the room other than his brothers. And he reveals to his brothers his true identity. And this is what he said. Dig in here. In Genesis 45, verses 4 and 5, Joseph says, "Please, come closer," he said to them. So they came closer. And he said again, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery in Egypt. But don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives." Wow. So the brothers returned to Canaan to get Jacob and their family to settle in Egypt upon Joseph's request. Because this comes back to our main thread of this sermon series. God is up to something. We can't see what that something is, but he is up to something. He's actively working at bringing back the shalom, the peace that was lost at the fall, in order to restore relationships, in order so that we might have a relationship with the Father, and in order so that we might have good relationships with one another. God made a covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God keeps his promises no matter if we cooperate or not. God's plan will be accomplished. The only question is, are we going to be part of his rescue plan? Joseph could have given in to despair at any point. He could have given in to self-pity. He could have given in when he was in the pit, when he was sold to the Ishmaelites, when he was sold to Potiphar, when he was thrown in prison or forgotten for another 2 years by the cupbearer. In the lows, Joseph kept his eyes on God. Also in the highs, he kept his eyes still on God, right? Because in the end, he could have said, "Ha, I'm Joseph," right? "It was you who did this." And instead, he saw what God was doing through this. Let's wrap up by giving some tools that we can use when we find ourselves in making any decision or when we're in a crisis or in a valley or in a struggle. Because what we often ask is, what do I do now? What do I do? The problem is this is the fourth question we need to ask, not the first question. These four questions are from a book that I've read. It's called I Can Change by Tim Chester. And this is what he says. The first question isn't, what do I do? The first question is who is God? Who is God? Right? Because we need to remember who God is. God is great. So we don't have to be in control. Because he's great, we don't have to be in control. God is glorious. Because of his glory, we don't have to fear others. God is good. Because he is good, we don't have to seek that from elsewhere. And God is gracious. So we don't have to prove ourselves. This is all about trusting God to be God. Do we believe these things? If we do, then we should not be anxious about anything in any circumstance. If these are the things that we believe, then we should move on to question two. What did God do? Or what is God doing? Right? In here, we need to talk about all the promises that God has made and kept in the Bible and in our lives. Right? Because of who he is. He sent Jesus to live amongst us. He lived a sinless life, showing us the way. Even though he was God, he took our place and died on the cross. But not staying dead, he rises again, conquering sin and death, making a way for us to be reconciled with God. So, just so you know, don't tell Jeff, but that's a spoiler for the story to come. We're going to see this again, right? So in this question, we can also look at how have we seen God work in our lives, his promises to us, and how we've seen him fulfill those things, how he's taken us through tough times, how he's been through us through good times. And so when we see who God is and what he's done, we can then move on to the third question. In light of those two things, who am I? In light of who God is and what he has done, it has to lead to I'm a follower of Christ. Because if I believe one and two, three is inevitable. Because if you believe that God is all those things, and if you believe that God has done all those things, that's the only thing left to do is say, I want to follow him. And if that's who you are as a follower of Christ, then that leads us back or to the fourth question, which is actually the original question. Then if all those things are through, what do I do? We take a step of faith and we trust God. These are the four questions that we ask in any decision or crisis. This is what Joseph did. He never wavered because he knew that who he belonged to and that was the determiner of how he responded in every situation, high or low. The struggle is we want to compare ourselves to our family, to our friends. We want to look left, we want to look right instead of looking up. There is no way Joseph could have foresaw how God would keep his covenant through his family. But he trusted God through every step. Joseph looked up and he knew he was God's and that God was in control. He knew he was created on purpose for his purpose, even though he saw no way through. Our response is the key. It has to affect our behavior. This has to be about heart change. If you know a lot about God, that does not lead to a more loving you. It does not, if you know a lot about God, it does not lead to a more joyful you, a more peaceful you, a more patient you, kinder you, gooder you, gentler you, self-control, right? There's no way that you will grow in those ways if you only know about God. The only way you grow in Christ is by trusting him. What does Joseph believe about God? He believes that God is with him. He believes that God has a plan. He knew God was in control, and Joseph had to be himself. He had to be himself who God had created him to be. You know, we waste a lot of time trying to be something we are not. God created us with gifts, talents, personality for a divine purpose. Do you believe that? When you look in the mirror, do you believe that about you personally? Because God does. Joseph knew that God was in control. We need to know that too. We need to know that he loves us how we are. He wants to grow and change and transform us to be like him. And I'm not talking about the all-knowing and the all-powerful. I mean all the other stuff. In our humility, in our servant nature, in our love, in our grace. We need a paradigm shift. We need to live our lives on purpose. We need to be who God created us to be. I'm going to wrap up with this. When I was sick last year, I have Meniere's disease, and it caused me for a year where I was so out of commission for so much of it. It gave me bouts of vertigo most days. One of our sisters in Christ, who makes CRBC home, she gave me a present. And so I unwrapped it, and I would have brought it, but it's packed up in all our stuff. We're moving in a month and a bit, and I would there's no way I'd be able to find it. But this is what it says, or thereabouts. So it's a mug. And so I opened it up, and this is what it says. Don't tell God how big your problems are. Tell your problems how big your God is. And this is my last verse. In Hebrews 12, 1 to 2, and I'm reading this out of the NASB, it says this. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. God is writing his story so that we can lean into him and be a part of it, because he is going to accomplish his mission.